Ken McLeod. From the day we launched unfetteredmind.org, it has operated without a paywall, advertising, or a subscription charge. This is only possible through the generosity of people like you. If you find our materials useful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate. Thank you, and enjoy this podcast.
Unfettered Mind, Heart Sutra Workshop, Part 4.
And this morning I talked about two qualities in meditation, resting and looking. They're intimately related. They're both very important. Resting doesn't mean sitting still. It doesn't mean holding a posture. It means resting. It's fine to work hard at your practice and to push yourself very, very hard. But only if there's an element of softness in your practice. Once you become hard, there is no quality of resting. And the consequence of that will be that something breaks. It's not terribly good for things to break in practice. They're quite hard, often impossible to repair. I know, because I've seen enough of it. Kala Rinpoche used to talk about how they stored liquids in Tibet. Store them in leather bags. Fill a bag with water. And over time it would become hard. And when it started to become hard, it was in danger of cracking, thus leaking. So when the leather became stiff and hard, before it cracked, it was reworked and became soft. Then you could carry water in it again without fear. Other leather bags were used for carrying butter. The oil and the grease from the butter gradually impregnated the leather. And the leather became very hard and very stiff. But no amount of kneading made it soft. When the bags came to that point, they had to be thrown away. And he said, never let your mind become like that. It's very, very important. So as long as there's an element of softness, of resilience, not just hardness, then it's fine to push in your practice. But when things become hard inside and outside, and it's the time to stop, take a break, rest. Yes?
How do people see that themselves?
It's a very important, how do people see that themselves? It's a very important skill to learn. It's very important to tell when you're pushing too hard and to learn how to back off. And if you have ambition and little things like that in you, those parts of you can continue to run even when you've backed off. So it can get a little tricky. That's why I'm mentioning it. Because I've seen enough of the harm which comes from this. And it's pretty serious. Looking also I mean, resting also doesn't mean just going. There's an awake quality in resting. And that form of resting is a more complete rest than being asleep. Quite literally, it's more restful. So cultivating this relationship with resting is very important. But by itself, it's not enough. You also have to learn to look. Because there's an element of seeing. And you simply can't see if you don't look. Unfortunately, the way most people look falls into two categories, so they're somewhat related. One is to step back and look. Become the observer. This is not conducive at all. In the Mahamudra tradition in which I was trained, we make no use of the observer at all. We regard it as a distraction. I know in other traditions, such as the Gelugpa and the Theravada, it's regarded as very important. We regard it as a distraction. You have to learn how to look while you are in the experience. You aren't looking at the experience. You are looking in the experience. It's a little different. The other problem that many people fall into with looking, we can call the attorney problem. No offense to any attorneys who may be here. I have several in retreat. They regularly take offense, so it works out. And among my students, inexperienced and unskilled attorneys do not know when to stop asking questions. They ask too many questions. And that's what often happens with people who look. Because we develop the quality of looking by asking questions. I asked a few questions today that caused you to look in certain ways. But once you're looking, the question doesn't help you do any more. You rest in the looking. That's very important. So, I asked this morning, what experiences all of this? And you look. And it's just like asking, what's that up there? And people don't go, I wonder what that is up there. Don't think about it. You look. And that's the quality that you want in the practice. You look. And then you rest in the looking. Putting those two things together is very, very important. When you can rest in the looking and look in the resting, then you're practicing the perfection of wisdom. Because what do you see when you look? Anybody? What do you say there, Kent?
No, not much.
Well, I think you have to go a little further than that. What do you see when you look? Not much. What do you see when you look? I don't think it is not much. What do you see? Look at your mind. What do you see? Anybody? Nothing. You see nothing whatsoever. How long can you look at nothing whatsoever? I had a painting. I gave it away when I moved my office, but it hung in my office for many years. And when I moved my office, I was putting it up, and the only place that was logical was above my assistant's workstation. And she said, "Why? What's that painting, Ken? It's nothing." And it's a piece of minimalist art. It's about this big, and it's a very, very dark green, almost smooth canvas, almost smooth acrylic on canvas, with a tiny bit of unpainted canvas at the bottom. And the green is so dark that most people think it's black. And I said, "It's a meditation test." And she said, "What?" I said, "When people can see this painting, they learn to look at nothing." I said, "That's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard, Ken." Fast forward 3 years. There's a student of mine who's come quite regularly over these 3 years. He finishes seeing me, comes out to meet with Celia and write a check. And as he's doing so, he says to Celia, "When did you get that painting?" And Celia looks at me and says, "I don't believe this." We turn to the student, and Celia herself says, "It's been there all the time you've been coming." And he says, "No." I said, "Yeah. We put it up when we first moved into the office. Ken said this exactly thing would happen. I didn't believe him, but you just proved he was right." Because when we are looking and we at nothing whatsoever, what do we become? All together now. Nothing whatsoever. Okay? How do you feel about that? No. Most people are scared out of their minds. Yeah. They go, usually when people see it, as Mumbi was describing earlier, I'm hearing form is emptiness, emptiness is form, is like, "Let me out of here. 3 seconds ago, please." And this is where a capacity in attention is very important. You have to have a sufficient capacity in attention that you can rest in the experience of seeing nothing whatsoever. And all kinds of possibilities come from that. So this looking and this resting, very, very important. Okay, a little bit more of the sutra. So now it comes to the mantra. And the mantra, as someone who's well-versed in these things reminded me, it's pronounced Om Gate Gate Paragate Parasamgate Bodhisvaha. We tend to put the emphasis in English on the penultimate, but it's never on the penultimate in Sanskrit. It's not Ananda, Ananda, it's Ananda. So it's gate, gate, paragate, parasamgate, bodhisvaha. So it has a very different lilt to it because of that. The mantra is basically a mnemonic. It's a way of memorizing the sutra. I talked about emptiness, take one, take two, take three, take four. And then the last bit is awakening. All Buddhas are three times awakened to unsurpassable true complete awakening. And that's the structure of the mantra. Gate is emptiness, take one. Gate is emptiness, take two. Paragate, which means gone beyond, is emptiness, take three. Parasamgate, which means gone completely beyond, is emptiness, take four, holding on to absolutely nothing. and then there's awakening, bodhi. And svaha is just that, so be it, amen, whatever. Ah, the party. Well, we have got two small things to do before we get to the party. So, Avalokiteshvara says all this. Buddha stirs from his samadhi and says, well done, the son of Noble family. Stubborn ox. Yesterday, a smart slap. Today, a handful of hay. Don't expect thanks, Chekhova said. Fair enough. Seeking praise is one thing. Receiving praise is another. Some teachers you just can't please. You bust your ass in practice. You have visions, dreams, and very strange experiences. You tell her about them and ask for help, but all she says is, not good, not bad, keep going. One day you just know and you don't even bother to ask. Later she drops by and you tell her. Now she makes a big fuss. Meanwhile, you're just sitting there saying nothing. Some teachers you just can't please. Thus it is. Thus it is. This is what Buddha says. You look into his eyes. He looks into yours. Whether it's the beginning, the middle, or the end, you know. And you know that he knows too. Thus it is. And so everybody's happy. When we come to the conclusion, then Venerable Shariputra and Noble Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva, that whole assembly and the world with its gods, humans, titans, and sky spirits rejoiced and praised the words of Lord Buddha. I wanted to say, and praised the words of the Lord, but that has a little different meaning in English. The final accolade. The curtain descends, the party is over. The guests leave, tipping the parking valets as they exchange the usual pleasantries, leaving behind scattered plates of unfinished food and half-empty glasses. Where will they go? What will they do? It's been a long night and you've probably eaten too much. If anything rattled you, don't throw up. Let it work in you until the you that you are now is fatally poisoned. The importance of conventional life is greatly exaggerated, and a good death can do wonders. Look at this mess. Time to clean up. Put the leftovers outside for those who couldn't come, because they were confused, lost their way, had better things to do, or were detained by the authorities. As for the authorities, may the dark forces of compassion, the black weapon-wielding monsters in tiger-skin kilts and elephant-hide shawls, riding rabid bears and demon horses, correct and complete anything I've left undone. Here's my prayer for you. May you never sleep. May you never eat. May you never go home. May you never find a path. Remember, the reason to know emptiness is to be able to act and rest freely. How do you act? Let the struggles of others be your guide. How do you rest? Let the struggles of others be your guide. So in the short time that we have remaining, I want to talk a little bit about how you live this. Two or three things that I found helpful. The first is that the only thing we have is what we experience. The only thing we can know is what we experience. Anything outside of that is projection or speculation. So, the first thing is to be completely in your experience all the time. When you do that, you find that as we discussed earlier today, there aren't any sentient beings out there. We don't experience any sentient beings. I think it's in the Lankavatara Sutra, maybe one of the other ones. Question is, why do bodhisattvas have infinite compassion for sentient beings? Know what the answer is? Because there aren't any sentient beings. When you open to your experience in this way, however, you become aware of something else, that there are an infinite number of sentient beings. They're not out there. They're inside. We all think the problem is in having a self. It'd be much easier if we had one self. Sadly, we don't have one self. We have tens, hundreds, thousands of selves. And they're engaged in us, all struggling to survive, and each in their own different ways. There's a self which knows everything. There's a self which feels it knows nothing. There's a self which is proud. There's a self which is ashamed. There's a self which can't bear the slightest discomfort. And there's the self which is going to tough things out. It doesn't matter what happened. Anybody else have any of these selves? I just like to check this now and then because sometimes I feel very, very alone. I know. But I have a big predilection for the self that feels alone. Does anybody know of a website called despair.com? Oh, you've got to go to despair.com. You know these motivational posters they have in things? Well, these are demotivational posters. My favorite is a picture of a bear in the middle of the rapids of a river, in which there's salmon jumping up the river, and there's a salmon jumping right in his mouth. And the caption is, "A journey of 1,000 miles can end very, very badly." But the one I'm thinking of shows a lone pine tree on this snowy slope and says, "Do you sometimes have the feeling that you are alone? You are not alone. On the other hand, you are alone, very alone. Anyway, we have all of these selves. Now, each one of these selves arises from being unable to experience something completely in the course of our growing up. They all contain emotionally charged residues of that experience. And when anything comes along which reminds us of one of those experiences, that self pops up and works as hard as it can to dissipate attention so that we don't actually experience anything. You may notice that you only get angry when you feel you are weaker than what you are opposing. So you get angry to get away from that experience of weakness. It doesn't work, of course, but that's what we do. So we have oodles of these, infinite sentient beings. And the best way to describe the relationship among all of these selves is that they're engaged in their own Darwinian struggle for resources. That's what we are. And what we are is the result of the evolution of this particular ecosystem. You thought you had a coherent personality. That's a story we tell ourselves when we go to sleep, but it's not true. You know how I got involved with Buddhism? All was because of a guy in my apartment mate at university called Louis Silcox. I had a scholarship to do graduate work in mathematics in England. And my fiancée suggested, it'd be nice to just go traveling around the continent. I thought that would be fun too. So I was mentioning this to Louis one evening, and he just looked at me and said, "MacLeod, you don't have the guts." And that was it. Anybody else have something like that in their history? You know? Without Louis, I wouldn't be here today. You can write thank you notes or notes of revenge, whichever you want. Anyway, so we have all of these selves. And they're struggling one over the other, trying to know, I want to take this care of this situation. Oh, no, we need to do this in this situation. Anybody know this? Oh, okay. This is your world of experience. And most of the time, we're in this one, or that one, or that one, and we move like this. This is called samsara. And we think we know what we're doing all the time. See, it's a lot worse than you thought. These are the six realms. Well, we can divide them up very nicely. You see, just like the traditional diagram. And this is the God's realm, you know. This is, all of this stuff, you see. And each of the realms has a mantra, you know. You know what the realm, the God mantra for the God's realm is? I'm right, and that's just how it is. Yeah. So that's it. Now, instead of being locked in this realm, and this realm, and this self, and this self, and this self, and this self, there is another possibility. And that's why I led you through that meditation this morning. We can be in the experience of the whole mess. We can experience the whole mess. Very few people want to do that. Why? Well, number one, it's a mess. And you experience all of that internal conflict and tension and stuff like that. And of course, if you're just opening to the experience of all, you don't get to decide any of it. But when you open to the experience of it all, something very magical happens. Things start to take care of themselves. Now, a particular application of this is the experience of a block. How many of you have experienced blocks in your lives, in your practice? Okay, just a few people. This is a block. I can draw a block. But this isn't the full block system. You know, that's just a brick. It only becomes a block when something tries to move. Right? So a block always consists of two components. Something which is trying to move and something that isn't moving. Everybody with me? Now, what we call a block when you've identified with this part. You say, this is me, I'm trying to move. And something is blocking me. There's a block. Right? But we could just as easily identify with this part. And if you identified with this part, what would you say? Something's pushing me around. There's another possibility. You could identify with neither of them and just open to this whole experience. What would that be like? Well, on the one hand, that's a little frightening because now you don't know what's going to happen. On the other hand, if you stepped out of a struggle. So that's a particular application of what I was just talking about. Now we come to this minor matter of relationships. There's me and my world of experience. Call this person A. And here's person B. Now, as we established earlier today, there's no possibility of sharing experience, much less exchanging. Remember, we went through that whole thing? Okay. But there is a point of contact. Anybody here practice Tai Chi? Push hands? Yeah. Just one-handed push hands. You know what I mean?
Okay. Yeah. I've always done it two hands.
I know.
I can probably fake it.
Yeah, I'm sure you can. Okay. So Jim's going to try to push me over, and I'm going to try to push him over. Well, you don't want to do that because you may end up being pushed over.
I know. I was waiting for that.
Well, I was being kind. See? So we're doing this thing. Oh, you're leaving me open. You're leaving yourself open there.
It's been a while.
Yeah, okay. But you see what's happening. Now, Jim, what are you paying attention to here?
The contact, the point of contact.
Are you paying attention?
I'm talking to you right now.
Yeah. Could you do this with your eyes closed?
Yeah.
Oh, so close your eyes. I can do it with my eyes closed too, okay? Do you see any difference?
Very little difference, actually.
Pardon? Yeah. He's actually pretty tense because I can put him over right there. Oh, yes. See, if you push on me that way.
Yeah. You could have pushed me over right there.
I know I could have. I'm being kind to you. But he pushes. See, and he gets hard when he pushes.
That's right, which allows me to be pushed over.
Exactly. If he stayed soft when he pushes, go ahead.
When I push?
Yeah, stay soft. Then there's no possibility of me pushing. Feel the difference?
Yeah.
See, when I push, I'm staying very soft. Now you got hard. Okay. But you see what this goes on. And the only thing we have here is the point of contact. Now, if you were just watching this, would you say we were having a fight?
No.
What would you say we were doing?
Dancing.
Yeah, thank you. All you have is the point of contact, nothing else. I call this the black box approach to relationships. You make absolutely zero assumptions about what's going on over there. You pay attention to your world of experience, everything in it, including the point of contact, because everything you need to know comes through there. I know exactly where Jim is, what he's doing, solely through the point of contact at the back of my hand. Nothing else. There's a story, probably apocryphal, but it's useful anyway, of these scientists who observed that a duck, one species of duck, would, when she was sitting on a clutch of eggs, would get up periodically and turn the eggs over. And the result was that the eggs were evenly warmed, so they hatched properly. So, being scientists, they wanted to figure out what the biological clock mechanism was. So they did all kinds of experiments and tests, etc. And they eventually came to the conclusion that there was no biological clock mechanism. Do you know when she turned the eggs over? When she was feeling too hot. Point of contact. So imagine in your relationships that you are so sensitive and so in tune with your experience that you know exactly what's going on in you. And in being that open and clear within oneself, then as soon as anything starts to move, which is moving things out of balance, you begin to correct it, which is exactly what I was doing with Jim. He would push, oh, he's pushing there. Well, we'll move that way. And so you have this play which just goes back and forth, and it becomes a dance. But you don't have to assume or speculate anything about what the other person is thinking or doing. You're paying complete attention to your own experience. What?
That's revolutionary.
Okay.
That's hard.
Which?
Maybe not making the whole story about what they're thinking, feeling, doing.
Would you have a mic here, please?
I was just saying that that seems to be the hard part sometimes.
Yeah.
In relationships, because you have the whole story about what they did to me before, what their usual pattern is, why are they always doing this to me, you know, and so you're not focusing on that particular moment of contact.
That's right. In other words, you're not in the experience. You see, relationships like this, two people are relating. This person has an idea. Of what's going on. And this person has an idea of what's going on, right? What's the relationship between this and this? It can be frighteningly little. Really, okay? So, if you're going to act on your idea of what's happening in the relationship, Jim, can you come back here for a moment? Here's what happens. Now, you saw how we were moving before, and we'll just demonstrate that again. Okay? So, we're just going back and forth. We're each trying to push each other over. And, okay, now, I want you to think about what I'm doing. Okay?
Okay, go ahead.
See what happens?
Stand up, I feel like this.
You know, I mean, everything just stops. Thank you. That's what happens. Because there's no dance now. Suddenly go all up here, and all of that nice fluid motion just disappears. So, don't do this. Try this. Okay? It's all very simple stuff. Simple doesn't equal easy. Last one. How many of you have heard of the middle way? How many of you know how to practice it? It's extremely important. The middle way in Buddhism is defined, and this is the official definition. I have oodles of scripture to back me up. Not falling into an extreme. That's a very strange definition for a middle way. So, the usual one is order and chaos. You'll usually see this translated as nihilism and internalism, but those are rotten translations. It's order and chaos. Now, how many of your lives have an element of order in them? How many of you, dear lives, have an element of chaos in them? Okay. And that's the situation we all live in. There is both order and chaos. What happens if you try to live your life completely ordered? Yeah. All kinds of things, right? Okay. And what if you live your life chaotically, what happens?
Burnout.
Yeah. So neither of them work. You have to live your life taking into account that, you know, you may live for like 70, 80, 90 years, and you're probably going to need some kind of retirement, so it's a good idea to put savings, etc. But you have no idea whether you're actually going to experience that because you could die tomorrow. Order, chaos. And by embracing this fundamental aspect of our existence, A, we're going to die. B, we have no idea when. We are actually practicing the middle way. It means embracing it, not trying to make it one way or the other. This culture exerts a tremendous amount of effort trying to make it one way. If anything prevents you from living until 75, somewhere between 75 and 90, something has gone wrong. You've got to sue somebody to correct that. It's, you know, and trying to make the whole society foolproof. This is, results in all kinds of distortions and imbalances in the society. It's a culture that has no way of relating to death. So the way to live the middle way is to include the experience of both poles in awareness all the time. Now this gets very interesting because it's not just about order and chaos. How many of you have experienced hurt in your life? And hurt that you may or may not have resolved, right? And the hurt can be from injustices in the social system to personal trauma or something. Okay. How many of you feel anger in relationship to that? Okay. I just want you to try a little experiment right now. Experience the hurt and the anger at the same time. What happens?
Sadness.
And that's moving in the direction of hurt, so include a bit more of the anger.
They disappear.
They disappear?
I was lost.
You went back and forth. Now you've got to experience them both at the same time, just like we did that opening exercise. Anybody else?
I
They nullify? They actually nullify, or does something else arise?
It almost feels like it's stabilizing.
Mm-hmm. Stabilizing, okay. Anybody else? Yes?
It's like when Buddha was holding space for Avalokiteshvara.
Mm-hmm. So these two poles can work it out between them. Is that what you mean?
Yes.
Okay.
Pardon? Polarity like a magnet.
Yeah, it is polarity like a magnet, but now you're experiencing the magnet instead of the poles. Because normally, I think that I hadn't thought of the magnet. I like the analogy, so I'm going to use it today. I'm stealing it from you, Mumbai. See, a magnet has a north and a south pole. And you have fields of force, goes like this. That's what it looks like generally. Actually, I think I've got that wrong. But anyway, you get the idea. And we're either here, and this is all bad, or we're here, and this is all bad. But when we're here, we don't experience that, and when we're there, we don't experience this. In other words, we don't experience the whole system. But when you experience both of these, now you get the full experience of the whole thing. And that's how you practice the middle way. Because you find that you become aware when you, this is pole one and this is pole two. When you hold both poles, you immediately become aware of the whole spectrum between them. And there are so many other possibilities because of the spectrum. In other words, by holding both poles and not falling into one or the other, then you experience how both poles are a manifestation of some underlying principle. Give a very simple example of that. What is the underlying principle of black and white?
Color.
Yeah, color. What's a world of color compared to a world of black and white? A few more possibilities, aren't there? Yeah. And that's how we practice the middle way. You open to both. Now, usually, we don't want to open to both. When we're feeling hurt, we just want to feel hurt. And when we're feeling angry, we just want to rage. You hold those two together. You don't get to be the victim. You don't get to be the hero. Because you're opening to the whole experience. And your world is enriched with all kinds of other possibilities. And you often find ways of resolving conflicts internally or externally because you're open to so many more possibilities. So these are three methods that I've found a bit helpful in applying the principles of the perfection of wisdom in daily life. Questions? Yes. Microphone, please.
A very practical assistance with holding the two poles. I have a lot of anxiety about the upcoming elections. And I have a real strong tendency towards anxiety and worry and all that. And I don't even know what the balance is for anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
So how can I work? And in any case, you know, right now it's the political environment, but tomorrow it will be something else and then something else. It's just a predominant theme.
Anxiety is usually a expression of hope and fear, right? Hold both the hope and the fear. What are you hoping for? What are you fearing? Hold them both.
Thank you.
Okay.
Other questions? I want to say one more word about application. Generally, people seek how to apply these practices to their lives. I think this is very problematic. There's a very, in some traditions of Buddhism anyway, there's a very, very deep bias regarding life, and it's entrenched in vocabulary, at least in the Tibetan tradition. You know, you have your word for meditation sessions, which is tun, and then you have the word for the rest of your life, which is tun tsang, which means between meditation sessions. In other words, from this point of view, you're only truly living when you're meditating. And this kind of attitude has come up a lot, various groups in the West, and it creates a real tension between people's spiritual practice and their lives. They only regard their, they think, they feel, oh, my spiritual practice, I can't put as much energy into it as I want because it's going to take away time from my life. And so it ends up with a total no-win situation. It's very, very destructive. So I don't like that way of thinking at all. I prefer to think of practice in this way. Practice is the cultivation of attention. Cultivation of attention, exercise of awareness, whatever you want. During your formal meditation periods, you are cultivating attention unmixed with other activities. During the rest of your life, you're cultivating attention mixed with activities. So when you're walking, you walk in attention. When you speak in attention, and so forth. Which doesn't mean to watch every word that you say, it just means to listen to yourself speak, so you hear the sound of your own voice while you are speaking. Very few people do that. They start speaking and they stop listening to themselves. They just go on and on and on and say things that they really wish they hadn't said. If you're listening to the sound of your own voice, as if you're listening to another person, you will very rarely say something you regret. Because as soon as you start down that road, you'll hear the difference in your voice and something will go, I don't think this is such a good place to go. So, rather than think of bringing practice to life, think of bringing life into your practice. So that, how do I bring walking into my practice? How do I bring washing the dishes into my practice? How do I bring taking care of my children into my practice? And this is very important, because when we think of applying practice to life, we think of finding this nice, calm clarity, and then we're going to take that nice, calm and clarity and bring it to life. How well does this work? As I said, the best military plans last until first contact with the enemy. If you bring your life into practice, then two things shift. One is, you have no choice but to find that calmness and clarity within the experience of life itself. You're not going to bring it to life, you have to find it in your experience. Which is exactly what we have to do anyway. And the second thing is, it's a practice. How many times have you failed to practice meditation perfectly? 1,000? Million? That's why we call it a practice, because we don't expect to succeed. We just keep trying. That's what you do in your life. You bring your life into practice. Okay, I didn't do that so hot. Let me try it again. And so one tends to take a much less punishing attitude to oneself, which in turn creates the willingness to make further efforts. Because you don't, how many have that harsh critic flying around in them? Yeah. So that's the last piece, I think. Take your practice, take your life into your practice and work with these tools. You will fail thousands of times. So you've already failed that way in your meditation. It hasn't stopped you from practicing meditation. You know. So you haven't walked mindfully down the street. Well, maybe next time. Maybe next time. Okay, other questions before we close? Nothing else? Please, Kent.
I've got one about Bodhi.
About Bodhi.
Bill Bodhi, a friend of mine. Bodhi, what are we waking up to? And is there a knowing component in there? I mean, do we know the nature of our experiences? So what's it like to be awake?
Everybody knows that. You say no? I disagree.
Yeah, I'm disagreeing with you, but it seems like I want, you know, sometimes you hear in some traditions that freedom, you can't.
Use the microphone, please.
In some traditions, Theravada tradition, freedom results from knowing the nature of your experience. Three marks. We already got rid of that, so you don't need to know it's empty. Or anything.
There's lots and lots of misconceptions here.
So what's Bodhi, you know, from your point?
Well, the more aware you are, the less freedom you have. All of you have at least one area of your life where you are expert. Some of you are doctors, attorneys, massage, business people, whatever. The more you know about a subject or a discipline, the more clearly you see what is possible and what is not. People who don't know about that particular discipline may think, well, we could do A, B, C, D, or E. But if that is your discipline, you see that A, B, and C are non-starters, maybe D, but the only real possibility is E. You know what I mean? So the corollary of this is that the more aware you are, the less freedom you have, because you see exactly what can and can't be done. And so the logical extension of this is that if you are completely aware, you have no freedom. You only see what can be done. So I like to say that the illusion of choice is an indication of the lack of freedom. Now, good. Exactly the result I was aiming at.
That's not part of the anything's possible.
Oh, yeah, anything's possible. Yeah. It's possible to be that awake or present. Now, you ask, what is awakening like? There's a certain circumstance which many people, and I'm sure many of you, have experienced, where a close friend or relative has experienced a very significant loss. Maybe a child has died, maybe they lost their job, maybe their marriage has come to an end. But something really, a really significant loss has occurred. And they turn to you, saying, and they start to tell you about it. And you don't know where the words come from. You don't know where the actions come from. But something in you knows what to say, what to do, how to say it, how to do it with your friend. When you look back at that experience, it often seems quite magical. It has a special quality. And when you reflect on it, you realize that there is absolutely no sense of self. There is a quality of presence and peace in which what needed to happen simply happened. And you don't even feel like you were the agent of it. Do you know what I mean? That's what it's like to be awake. Okay? Good. Other questions? If not, I will not bore you any longer. Have a very good evening. A pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Mind retains all rights to these podcasts. If you do wish to use a part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.